The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about mindfulness, and especially the many different dimensions of mindfulness. In fact, it could be called the jewel of mindfulness with its multifaceted nature. So the practice that we do here and that we teach here at IMC is called mindfulness meditation. So what is mindfulness? It might be good to know what that is. And it's not that you learn the definition of mindfulness once and then you know what it is. Okay, this is mindfulness and this is the meditation that we do. Rather, understanding mindfulness is a journey unto itself. It's something that evolves along with our practice. And the more we explore, the more we see that mindfulness is very multifaceted. It's a multidimensional jewel that shines in different ways under different conditions. So our understanding of mindfulness deepens along with our practice, and it indeed enables our practice. Now, mindfulness is becoming a popular term in a lot of other fields, like psychology, the medical world. You may have heard of mindfulness-based stress reduction, neuroscience, and even places like schools and other public types of institutions are starting to use mindfulness, talk about mindfulness. You can almost go and say this word, and people will just understand what you mean in some of these settings. So exploring mindfulness in meditation practice is worthwhile because sometimes we use it a little differently in the Buddhist context than it's used out in these popular areas, and some of that may be highlighted in what we're talking about also. So I'd like to bring in many different aspects and ways of understanding mindfulness through the course of this talk. And the point is not to stay at the level of terminology or get all tangled up in the semantics, but really to appreciate the multidimensional nature of mindfulness and to then point it towards our own practice and begin to understand some of the dimensions that manifest in our own practice of mindfulness. So that we start from the same place, the Pali term for mindfulness is sati. It's usually translated as mindfulness. In Pali, this word means memory or recollection, and it actually means that in both senses of the word. It means recollecting that we intend to pay attention to a certain object, like our breath, for example, so we have to remember in order to keep doing that. I'm sure you've all experienced this in meditation. Your mind doesn't really stay with the object. And it also means recollecting our mind onto the object when it has wandered. So a lot of people experience the return of mindfulness as a gathering, a focusing, or a bringing in, like the mind used to be looking out the window and then you bring it in, or it used to be looking through a window and then you open the window and it's clearer. There's sort of a sense of clarity or gathering. So mindfulness means keeping our intention to meditate in mind, being present in this moment instead of wandering off into thought or fantasy of some kind. So there are two classic analogies to depict what mindfulness is, the practice of it, just so the basic way that we go about developing it. One is that a house with five windows and a door that represent the five regular senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, and then the door is the mind, so ideas and other things that might come into the mind. And we are sitting, the image is that we're sitting in an easy chair in the middle of the room. And things may come and appear in the window or come through the door, try to distract us, and our job is just to stay in the chair and let them come and go. Actually, I printed out some instructions from Gil's intro to meditation course. The windows are open and the door is open. A cat peeks its head in the door and then goes away. Soon a bird lands on the windowsill and then flies away, and then a squirrel runs by. Various animals come and go. rather than getting up to follow the animals outside or closing the doors and windows, you just stay in your easy chair and simply watch what comes and goes. The instruction for mindfulness meditation is just to stay in the easy chair of awareness and let sensations, emotions, thoughts, or attitudes simply appear at the door or window of our sense perceptions. We notice them come and go. Simple. Not easy, but simple. And then the second image is somewhat similar. It focuses more on the desire aspect. So that is to imagine the six sense bases as six different animals. And you tie six ropes, one to each animal, and then you tie the other end of them all together in a big knot, and then you let the knot go. And if you do that, you can imagine that all the animals are just going to pull in different directions, going everywhere. And this is describing the unmindful mind. So we see something we want, we hear something that we want, we think about something that we want, and we're just pulled in all these different directions, and we never really get anywhere because we're just doing this, doing that. And mindfulness in that case is depicted as a stake, and you put it through the central knot and into the ground, and the animals can't go anywhere, and eventually they get tired and they lie down calmly. So this is also the hope of meditation, is that we sit down, the mind's going everywhere, we put in the stake of mindfulness, and eventually things settle down and we can experience some degree of peace. This may or may not happen in any given meditation, but you can get the image. So, yeah, in this case, actually, Andy Alinsky had a very nice description of this. So he says, mindfulness practice offers the restraint necessary to overcome the tug of desire upon the senses. As we notice the mind wandering off to explore a gratifying train of thought, or as we notice the body's urging to nudge ourselves into a more comfortable position, we gently abandon the impulse and return attention to the primary object of awareness. We do this again and again until the mind becomes content, being fully present with what is manifesting here and now in the field of experience, rather than rushing off to some other form of stimulation. As the mind settles down, it becomes considerably more powerful and thus more empowered. So this begins to point us toward the promise of mindfulness, which I'll get to later in the talk. You know, why are we doing this sitting here? So this opens the door then to a lot of explorations of the different dimensions of mindfulness. So I like to think of mindfulness as attention with a wisdom component. So it's attention, not just attention, it's attention plus non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion, or non-identification. So it's attention with no agenda, basically. It is very possible to attend to objects with an agenda. That's one of the most common challenges that we encounter in trying to establish mindfulness correctly, is that we're watching something, but we're not really watching it like we're sitting in an easy chair. We're watching it with some idea in mind. So, for example, if you're paying attention to something unpleasant and you're using the noting practice and you're noting the feeling tone and you find yourself saying, unpleasant, unpleasant, that might not be mindfulness. Or if you're having some very pleasant feeling and you're saying, pleasant, pleasant, you know, that's probably not mindfulness. Also, especially as we start to learn what mindfulness can do, we may pay attention to things with the purpose that they will go away. So we notice there's a pain in our leg, and sometime in the past, we've had an experience where mindfulness dissipated that pain a little bit. So we think, oh, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to sit here and pay attention to this pain. Come on, release, release. Aren't you going to go away? I'll just keep looking at this until it goes away. So again, that's not quite attention with no agenda. So this wisdom component can be talked about in a lot of different ways, and that's why there's so many different ways to talk about mindfulness. So here are a few, not to get caught in the vocabulary. But often this attention with a wisdom component is captured in an adjective that goes with attention. So for example, kind attention is often a translation of mindfulness. And that emphasizes the element of non-hatred or non-judgment, because one of the most common things that people will do is realize that they haven't been mindful, and then when they come back, they'll say, oh, bad, bad, I shouldn't have wandered away. Or they'll notice something arising for the 27 millionth time and say, oh, I should stop thinking about that. Why am I still, you know? And so kind attention allows us just to say, okay, you know, there it is again. It counteracts that tendency to judge. I've also heard a receptive attention. And I like this one because it points away from both greed and aversion. Something that's receptive is willing to take what comes and goes. It's not reaching out. It's not pushing away. So that one's pretty good. There's sometimes bare attention is used to describe mindfulness. You may have heard this. This attempts to capture the non-involvement with the object. So the aspect of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. So it's just bare attention, no agenda. I think it's a little confusing myself because it seems to imply a neutrality to mindfulness in the overall sense. Now, there is neutrality, but it's mindfulness is a wholesome state. So, it, you know, just paying attention, you know, paying attention to the fact that you're stealing something is not mindfulness because, you know, it's a wholesome quality. So there are various adjectives that capture this wisdom component. Sometimes there are other words that are connected to mindfulness that attempt to describe it more fully. Sometimes mindfulness is paired with the term clear comprehension. So we say mindfulness and clear comprehension, or in Pali it would be sati sampajanya. So this brings in a more contextual or time-related aspect to mindfulness. So it has to do with, are we aware of the appropriateness of our action, and are we aware of the purpose of our action? This is more in sort of a daily life practice. And it's also about not identifying with what we're doing, you know, not pretending that it's us doing it or not seeing it as an aspect of ourselves or a development of ourselves. So this is a little bit more than attention. It's attention plus understanding why and how we're doing what we're doing. There's also the word dhammavichaya, which means examination of the dhammas or experience. It means understanding what we're looking at in terms of correct models or maps of what we're doing. So, for example, if you're sitting there and your mind is completely raging away to everywhere, it's helpful if you know that that's the hindrance of restlessness. So then you can label it. You can say, okay, my mind is restless right now. So that's maybe has the understanding that you've heard at some point of the five hindrances. Or if your mind is just beating yourself up with judgment, you can say, ah, this is the hindrance of ill will. And so this examination of qualities is an important factor that adds that wisdom component to mindfulness. In fact, this is the second factor of awakening, this investigative factor, and mindfulness is the first. And sometimes it's said that in this interpretation of the two aspects of mindfulness, is that mindfulness, sati, is turning toward the experience, and the investigation is shining a light on it. So that, again, implies that mindfulness has this wisdom component. It's a little bit more than just the bare attention, just the plain attention. There's also the aspect of vigilance or heedfulness, which is a very important component of mindfulness. This is what makes mindfulness a guardian. It's sometimes said to be a guardian. It's a guardian of the sense doors. So remember that image of the animals with the stake? So mindfulness is the guardian of the sense doors. And it's also the guardian of our ethical behavior. If we're mindful, we're much less likely to make a mistake of lying or stealing or killing or any of the other precepts that we try to hold to. So it's also this vigilance or heedfulness is what is said to make mindfulness a balancing factor in the mind. Often just having mindfulness will help our mind reach a more of a state of normalcy or kind of balance with regard to energy and concentration, for example, or faith and wisdom, the faculties that are being balanced in order that our mind becomes stronger. It also plays the role of balancing the seven factors of awakening as we develop the mind to have more and more wholesome qualities. So mindfulness is actually the one component of the all the factors of awakening that you can't ever have too much of. So because it has this balancing or heedfulness or vigilant quality, it's always good. So I had an example, actually, of this balancing effect directly in my experience on a retreat I was on recently. I was doing walking meditation, just pacing back and forth, and I got to the end of the track at one point, and I just felt a little bit of fatigue in my body and maybe in my mind also a little dullness. And I remember just noting to myself, oh, the energy seems a little low. I didn't really think much of it. I turned around, continued with the walking meditation. And by the time I got to the other end of the track, I noticed myself perking up. My mind kind of had more energy and alertness, and my body was straightening up. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. And so I went and I told the teacher that I told him about this experience. And the language that I used was I said, just by noticing, the energy came back up. Just by noticing that the energy was low, it came back up. And he didn't quite let me get away with that, actually. He changed my language, and he said, actually, no, it wasn't just noticing. It was that you had mindfulness. And so he pointed me toward recognizing that just noticing might not be enough, and that mindfulness, in fact, that's the title of a book, I think, Noticing is Not Enough or Awareness is Not Enough. So mindfulness has to have this additional component of not identifying with it, not creating a story, not saying, oh, I'm so lazy, I'm not doing a good job on my walking meditation, I'm getting tired, or even just, you know, letting it pass by so quickly that I didn't really notice. So I did actually notice that the energy was low, and I didn't identify with it, and then it came back up. Great. If I could just remember that. So I've been throwing around a lot of terms, and the point isn't to try to remember them all. It's to notice that there's all these different aspects and angles. In fact, the wisdom component of sati is evident in another treatment of the teachings called the Abhidhamma, in which mindfulness is said to always co-arise with 18 other wholesome factors. I don't know how you see all of these at once, but we won't go into the details either. But every time there's a moment of mindfulness, the mind also contains a lot of other good stuff. It contains equanimity, non-greed, non-hatred, faith, various ethical factors, and on and on. There are 18 of them. So every moment of mindfulness, you're also developing all these other factors. Mindfulness is sort of the easiest door into having wholesome mind states, but any way that we get there, we're developing a lot of wholesomeness all at once. There's an interesting implication, by the way, of this Abhidhamma view of the mind, of consciousness, where multiple factors arise together. The fact that mindfulness always co-arises with several of the ethical factors, in particular the ones that guard us against doing harm, it means that mindfulness can't be divorced from ethics. So this starts to point out why the Buddhist understanding of mindfulness might be different from the way it's used more generally. People will talk about mindfulness-based stress reduction, for example, is taught completely in a non-Buddhist context. And it's a great program, and this is absolutely not any kind of a criticism of it or anything else. I myself have benefited from it. But it's to point out that in the Buddhist term sati, the development of it is inseparable from a foundation in ethics and virtue, as is the regular training of the Eightfold Path. So I hope this gives some flavor of the depth of this key quality. Mindfulness is not just something you learn once, you learn it again and again. And I want to talk now a bit about the benefits of mindfulness and the development of it in our practice. So when we see something with mindfulness, we are connected to it, but not entangled with it. So for example, when we see fear, the part that's aware of the fear is not afraid. That's a big insight when we have it, when we realize, oh, I'm looking at my fear. So that means whatever's looking is not afraid. Oh, gosh, we change from being that emotion to seeing that emotion. That's a powerful step. Or we shift from avoiding or averting or denying something to actually seeing it. So we're connected, but we're not stuck onto it, not entangled with it, not sucked in. The immediate benefit is that just this in itself brings great relief. When people have that first moment of seeing anger or fear, instead of just acting it out or reacting to it, they may touch a moment of peace that they didn't know was possible before. In fact, I wanted to read a little bit of an interview with Andrea Fella. I think many of you know her as a teacher here at IMC. And this is an interview about where she described a little bit about her entry into practice, you know, how she began practicing herself. She says, "One day I was in my kitchen cutting an apple, and I saw a thought go through my mind about being with my ex-boyfriend at a fruit stand. I saw the connection between the apple I was cutting and the fruit stand memory." Good mindfulness. "And I saw in my mind this strong pull to think more thoughts in order to get angry at him. So I really saw the intention toward anger in my mind. It occurred to me, I don't have to get on that train. I don't have to follow that thought. I stood there with the knife in my hand waiting to get angry, and I didn't get angry. And that was the moment that I was hooked on the Dharma because I saw its power. I think I actually sank to the floor with the knife in my hand. Wow, I thought, this stuff is really amazing if it can allow me to see the thoughts in my mind that move me in the direction that makes me so distressed and avoid that." So that is the immediate benefit of mindfulness. You know, we don't have to wait till we're an arhant or something to understand the power of this practice. Just that moment when she could have gotten angry. We know how painful anger is. It's no fun. And she didn't, because she saw what was happening in her mind. So you might be thinking, this sounds great. How do I get more mindfulness? How do I get this? So mindfulness is something that develops through our practice. And one thing that we run into right away is that we have somewhat of a lack of control. Because when does mindfulness arrive? It arrives out of a state of non-mindfulness. In other words, it arrives when we're totally lost. So the initial arrival of mindfulness, or the reestablishment of mindfulness, is basically an act of grace. Or we could say it's a natural phenomenon that arises on its own. We can't do it. We're lost. We're not doing it. So we just tend not to recognize it. So actually, mindfulness has been happening all the time. It's been happening your whole life, long before you came to practice. But you didn't necessarily notice it or value it. That's why it's so important that we have people around us who tell us, remind us how important mindfulness is, since we keep forgetting, moment after, in case you didn't notice that during your meditation, we keep forgetting how important it is and deciding something else is more important. So recognition and valuing of mindfulness is actually one of the main causes of it continuing to develop. That's why listening to the Dharma is so powerful. Another main cause of mindfulness is previous moments of mindfulness, it turns out. So Gill likes to say, no moment of mindfulness is wasted, and that's true. Every moment of mindfulness, at the very least, is contributing to future ones. You're conditioning yourself to be more mindful in the future and get even more benefit from the practice. So every single one counts. So here's another bit from Andy Olinsky. "In mindfulness meditation, we work to create the factors favorable to the arising of mindfulness, relaxing the body and the mind, focusing the attention carefully but gently on a particular aspect of experience, while producing sufficient energy to remain alert without losing a sense of ease and tranquility. Under such conditions, properly sustained, mindfulness will emerge as if by some grace of the natural world, as if it were a gift of clarity from our deepest psyche to the turbid shallows of our mind. When it does, we gradually learn to hold ourselves so that it lingers, to relocate or reenact it when it fades, and to consistently water its roots and weed its soil so that it can blossom into a lovely and sustainable habit of heart and mind. So the trajectory of mindfulness is toward greater and greater continuity. That's what he was talking about, sustaining it so that it becomes a continuous habit of mind. And the continuous presence of mind, coupled with wisdom, is what will eventually enable us to see the truth clearly. So it leads the mind directly toward liberation. We tend to speak of mindfulness as being established in a particular domain of experience or having a particular foundation or field that it's working in. That's what Andy Olensky was saying when he said, focusing the attention carefully but gently on a particular aspect of experience. So we can ask, well, what's the proper field for mindfulness? When we sit down, where do we establish this mindfulness? The Buddha taught four such establishments or foundations of mindfulness that are particularly useful for developing and eventually freeing the mind. They are articulated in the sutta called the Satipatthana Sutta, which contains many instructions for different ways of being mindful, both in meditation and in daily life, so that it can become continuous, something that we do all the time. And the four foundations are body, feeling tone, which means pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, mind, and mind objects, or sometimes called dhammas. And I won't go into the details on all of these, but essentially the instruction is that we are to abide ardent, fully aware, and mindful of these things in and of themselves. So that again captures the notion of just sitting and watching them arise and pass, come and go. And again, there's this notion of being ardent, fully aware, and mindful. And we're also instructed to let go of covetousness and grief for the world. So that talks about bringing attention wisely, not reaching towards, not pushing away. You can even be mindful of mindfulness. In fact, this is in the Satipatthana Sutta encourages us to notice whether our mind is mindful or not. That's what I asked at the end of the sitting. And I would extend that to noticing what the present experience of mindfulness feels like, which is also a contemplation that I offered. Basically, because mindfulness has this wisdom component to it, your experience of it is going to change because your wisdom changes over time. You get wiser as you practice, believe it or not. And so that means that your experience of mindfulness is going to be different as your practice develops. It's good to know this because I've had times in my practice when I was unsure that I was being mindful. It suddenly seemed to feel different when I sat down than it did before. Sometimes it evolved slowly, or sometimes there was a big change. And I would have these moments of doubt where I would think, is this working? What am I doing? And it turns out that in retrospect, I could see that my mindfulness had just changed a little bit because I was aware of different things. My wisdom had changed. There were other factors in my mind. It just had a different flavor, basically. It was manifesting in a different way. And just like at the beginning of practice, I had to recognize the mindfulness in its new form and value it. A beautiful insight that we can have about mindfulness is that we can hold anything with mindfulness. Any and all experiences can be noticed. This is actually not a trivial point. You may say, yeah, of course. But actually, we doubt this in both gross and subtle ways, even if you haven't been mindful of your doubt. So, for example, at first, we tend to doubt that the strongest emotions we have can really be held with mindfulness. A lot of people come to practice with a lot of anger or a lot of fear or a lot of anxiety, and they sit down and they think, there is no way, this is me, I am an angry person, there is no way I could ever just see this and not react to it. Or maybe they're happy with their anger and they say, I'm justified and I like my anger. And so, you know, then the concept of just watching it come and go like a bird at the window, that's very hard. So there's underneath that sort of justification or whatever could be a little doubt. I'm not sure I can really see that with equanimity and faith and ethical factors and all the things that come with mindfulness. Another way that we doubt the practice is that we experience mindfulness, for example, on a retreat or sitting here at IMC, and then we doubt that it can really happen in our daily life. You know, we think, okay, well, here, you know, we're all sitting here, and you know, we've set aside this time. But what about, can I be mindful while I'm hurrying in the morning to get everybody out the door? Can I be mindful while I'm talking? What would that mean? Can I be mindful in a staff meeting at work? We have little doubts about that, and maybe we don't apply ourselves to be mindful as much in those cases because we secretly think this isn't the right time to be mindful, it's too crazy. But actually, we can be mindful at any speed. It's not limited by how fast or slow or whether we're sitting still. We can be mindful in any activity. We can be mindful with any degree of pleasure or pain. It just feels different in different contexts, and we have to learn to recognize it and value it in each context that it can arise. And this doubt even shows up at subtle levels. So as the mind refines and we can actually be calm during meditation, experience can become very strange. We may encounter places in the mind we haven't really been before because it hasn't been that still before. And it can take quite a bit of faith to stay with these unusual experiences, simply remaining mindful and not making problems of them or interpretations of them. So the basic instructions for mindfulness actually never change. We just keep following them deeper and deeper. As deep as the practice can go, we always have to keep that sense of what mindfulness is and keep applying it moment after moment. This is insight practice. So you've gotten all the instructions you need for the rest of your practice over however many lifetimes. You've already got them. It's actually said that mindfulness is enough. It can take us all the way to liberation. We just keep connecting with our experience without grasping it, pushing it away, or identifying with it. And bit by bit, the mind will be freed. We might even stretch it a little bit to say that a moment of mindfulness is a momentary taste of something like freedom, because at that moment, we're just observing the experience. We're not entangled. No greed, no hate, no delusion. That's a moment of nibbana, essentially, an everyday moment of it. So every moment of mindfulness, you're practicing. And if we keep following that taste, if we keep recognizing and valuing that taste, little tastes of freedom, the mind will follow that trail of taste all the way to the taste of nibbana. So I hope this inspires you to notice and appreciate sati when it arises naturally, to encourage its continuance, so that you can keep gaining all the benefits that it offers, and to explore what mindfulness itself is and what it feels like for you as part of the path to freedom. Thank you. I would love to hear what some of you noticed at the end of that sitting about how mindfulness is for you, or if you have any other questions or comments.
Thank you for the talk. I noticed that for me, at the moment that you offered the reflection, I was not mindful. And that for me, it was like I was so involved with my thinking that things were very tight, constricted, and dark in a way. And that when I sat back, I felt like there was a lot of room, and this openness that happens with the mindfulness is really was a telltale to me of sort of moving back into mindfulness. So thank you.
Beautiful.
I was just wondering, is being mindful like an either or thing, or can I be like somewhat mindful? Because one thing, I've never heard that when you put it, like there's a moral aspect of it, like if I find I'm often mindful that I'm procrastinating. And I guess the way you would put it is that's not real mindfulness. Is it somewhat mindful? Or should I just stop doing that?
No, it's very good to be mindful of. We can be mindful of the hindrances or mindful of defilements in the mind. I didn't mean to imply that that wasn't real mindfulness. In a very detailed treatment of the mind, would say that the moment of mindfulness that you noticed you were procrastinating was the moment right after you were procrastinating. So you couldn't hold those two at the same time because the mindfulness is wholesome and the procrastination, which could be a form of aversion or it could be a form of sloth and torpor, is unwholesome. And so what you've done, though, with that moment of mindfulness, just so that you understand the process, is that you've shifted from being completely absorbed in an unwholesome mind state to changing your mind to a wholesome state that's observing simply an unwholesome object. The object of mindfulness actually doesn't matter. It turns out how we observe is much more important than what we're observing. And what you're observing and not being attached to is irrelevant compared to the value of the non-attachment. So as far as partial mindfulness, I think I would say that you're mindful or you're not, but that the mindfulness changes over time, as I described in the talk. And so the character quality of your mindfulness is going to be different now than it was a few months ago or than it is a couple years from now. But at any given moment, you're mindful or you're not. And please keep being mindful of procrastination, because that will change things eventually. Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit more about taking on sort of the grief of the world? You made a comment about that.
Yes, that refers to the beginning passage of the Satipatthana Sutta, which says, in order to establish mindfulness, we should put aside covetousness and grief for the world. And my understanding of what this means is that we decide that for the time that we are establishing mindfulness, a period of sitting or even in our daily life, we are not going to identify or be caught up in the concerns of the world. So that could be our daily life. It could be the world in the broader political sense. But for the moment, we're going to put that aside and focus on being aware of the particular object that we've chosen. Does that help, or did it not quite address what you were aiming at?
No, thank you. That is helpful, but that's something that I struggle with quite a bit.
Yes, absolutely, because we come here with a sense also of compassion. You know, we want to help. We see the suffering. We're told to look at the suffering, and then we think, you know, that's something that we all balance in our own practice. It's one way that people hold it is to notice that they are more effective in helping the world when they are not grieving for it. So I would point towards the aspect of mindfulness that is connected to something and not attached to it, you know, not entangled in it. But there is also the side that says you have to be connected to it. So we're not averting or avoiding or denying any suffering in the world or in ourselves, but remaining aware of it. Simply not falling into it. It's a balance. It's a delicate balance.
Recently in my practice, something came up, and you mentioned these words tonight, about greed, delusion, and aversion. And I found that greed and aversion, super easy to experience. Oh, wait a minute, yeah, all right, I really want this, or oh, I really don't want this, I hate this. And the delusion was a little more mysterious. Like, what's going on there? And I found myself getting kind of stuck for a while until recently something seems to have cracked where, like, all of a sudden I was kind of just caught up in between greed and aversion. Like, I saw this on one side, greed on one side, and aversion on the other. And I found myself almost a readiness stance. I can picture that as a feeling tone of like I was in like this athletic stance, ready to do something. And it just felt like, wow, my whole being is just ready to do something. It's waiting for a version or waiting for something that I want. Like, oh, wait a minute, maybe that's a delusion. Maybe I'm trying to preserve myself. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about delusion and maybe that feeling tone.
So just so I understand, when you had this feeling of readiness, that was kind of like the energetic aspect of your mind wanting to do something, the desire in your mind wanting to go for or against something. That's what you felt like?
Yeah, as if it was looking for something to do.
Okay.
Like it's always so maybe in that judgmental phase, like seeing that happen a lot, but then like it goes kind of quiet. And there wasn't a judgment per se, but it was just like, I mean, something's still there. There, like an energy state like that.
Okay. Could be restlessness. But you asked about delusion. Delusion is harder to see. It's certainly hard to see. That's the point. It has a couple different aspects that might help to get a sense of how it's operating in your mind. And this is true for every mind. The easiest way in often is that delusion is related to the sense of self. So if you are defining yourself or defending yourself or otherwise characterizing yourself in some fixed way, that's a manifestation of delusion. So for example, we can sit here and we can have a whole conversation in our mind around the fact that we're a busy person. Oh, I'm always busy. This is what I do. I have to be busy. And since I have to be busy, I think I should schedule more things next week than I have, because otherwise I'll get bored, and I hate that. And I have to be busy. And you notice the prevalence of the word I in this thought. And so seeing ourselves in a certain way, or saying, oh, it's impossible for me to speak in front of groups. So knowing that that's just true for me, I have to avoid this and that, and I need to change my job and such and such. And it's all based on this fixed idea that I can't speak in front of groups. Well, that's delusion, for sure. It's an I statement that's an absolute truth. So that's one way that delusion manifests, is these ideas of self. Another, which is maybe a little more subtle, is ignorance, and it's what we're not seeing. So we have a certain view or a certain way of seeing things, and because of that, we're actually blinded to something else. They do these wonderful neurology experiments where they show people. You guys heard about that one with the people who are playing basketball? They're passing a basketball around. It's a video, and there's a video of people passing a basketball, and people are instructed to count how many times the basketball is passed or something like that. There's some simple instruction. And during this video, somebody in a gorilla suit walks through. They walk right through the center of the people who are passing the ball and then out the other side of the field of vision. And later people are asked, well, did you notice anything strange? No? No? So this may not be delusion exactly, but this is how delusion works, is that we're focused on the task of where we were told to count the number of passes of the ball. In the same way, we can be focused on, you know, I want to see the world my way. And in the meantime, the gorilla walks through and we don't see it. So this is another manifestation of delusion. So harder to see, but maybe that gives you some sense of what to feel for in your mind. Is it gripping around the self and gripping around views or ways of seeing things such that you're blind to other things?
Thanks.
Well, it's actually 9:04, so thank you all for your mindfulness tonight.